The patterns of commoning.
The commons is not just an unowned resource that anybody can use, a free-for-all. It's a social system for collaborating and sharing and managing shared wealth. And so what I did with my German activist colleague, Silke Helfrich, was to collect dozens of examples from around the world in lots of different resource domains, from cities to digital spaces to farm settings and beyond, to show that the commons is actually a very sustainable, attractive, socially attractive way of managing shared wealth in ways that are fair and ecologically responsible.
That's David Bollier. We talk with him about the ancient social formation called the commons and the radically new versions it's taking and spreading around the world. His new book, co-edited with Silke Helfrich, is Patterns of Commoning. Then, the Rio Olympics are happening now in a Brazil plagued by corruption, conflict, and a de facto coup against President Dilma Rousseff. We re-air our October 2015 interview with Juliana Barbosa about her book, Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink. It's about how the preparations for the Olympic Games revealed the cracks in the Brazilian miracle. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. For the vast majority of human history, the dominant economic system was the commons. In fact, many anthropologists believe that it was our ability to cooperate in using shared resources that drove our evolution, including the development of language. So how did such a fundamental mode of human behavior fall into such disuse and even ill repute? We hear a lot about the tragedy of the commons, and nothing about its incredible success, even where practiced in our capitalism-dominated world. And just as an aside, what about the tragedy of private enterprise? You don't have to look very far to see how putting private profits over social needs is bringing us to the brink of planet-wide disaster. My guest David Bollier is at the forefront of the modern commoning movement. He was part of the first effort to establish an international legal framework for the commons and is the author of several previous books about the movement. We've talked with him about some of those books previously on this show. David Bollier's new book, co-edited with Silke Helfrich, is Patterns of Commoning. Collecting contributions from commoners around the world, it richly demonstrates the vitality of the movement and its expansion into multiple arenas, from seed banking to free and open software. The book covers neighborhood commons, both urban and rural, arts and culture commons, technology commons, exchange and credit commons, and biocultural commons. In its pages, a new, more convivial and sustainable means of organizing our economy comes to life. David Bollier, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here.
Well, this book, Patterns of Commoning, which you co-wrote with Silke Helfrich, is a book that really talks about what is positive, what is happening in the world of commoning today, as opposed to the barriers to commoning, which some of your other books have done. I wonder if you could talk about what commoning is. What is, I mean, even though it's ancient, what is new about it in this new context of how we need to change how we look at the world around us?
Well, if you mention the commons to someone, the first thing that they usually say is, oh yeah, the tragedy of the commons. And of course, this is comes from a famous 1968 essay called The Tragedy of the Commons, which claims that any shared resource will always be overused because nobody has any incentive to hold back. But the truth of the matter is the commons is not just an unowned resource that anybody can use, a free-for-all. It's a social system for collaborating and sharing and managing shared wealth And so what I did with my German activist colleague, Silke Helfrich, was to collect dozens of examples from around the world in lots of different resource domains, from cities to digital spaces to farm settings and beyond, to show that the commons is actually a very sustainable, attractive, socially attractive way of managing shared wealth in ways that are fair and ecologically responsible. And so that's really the gist of what we're trying to do, is show that the commons offers a different way beyond that of state bureaucracies or free markets that are predatory and unequal.
Right. You know, one of the things that I thought about was actually disasters. And just in reading the very first pages of this book, Patterns of Commoning, it put me in mind of Rebecca Solnit's book about disasters called A Paradise Built in Hell. Do you know that book?
Oh, it's a fantastic book. I really love that book.
Right. Well, so maybe you can draw out the parallel in some of the ideas that she talks about there. I mean, it's a book about the communities that arise in disasters. Talk about the commonalities between what she talks about there and your book.
Well, economists will tell you that we're selfish, materialist, utility-maximizing creatures. But what Rebecca Solnit did in her book was show that in earthquakes and tornadoes and floods, people had a paradise built in hell, as the title of her book was, meaning they had some of the most wonderful human bonding experiences of support and mutuality in the face of disaster. Well, you could say that our world right now is on the threshold of a lot of disasters. And what I found in my book, Patterns of Commoning, was dozens of robust, successful examples of people coming together to create social collaborations to deal with problems. Things like time banking in Helsinki, where people give time and get barter credits for it. Or things like the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, these open source coders who make instant maps for disaster areas like Haiti, so that people rescue in a humanitarian efforts can proceed. And you just find just a wealth of these kinds of examples, which is really kind of an archetype of human behavior that we just do not have represented in economics, politics, government, or many other places. And so that's what the commons is all about.
In fact, could you say that some of the anomie, to use a word that was coined by Durkheim in the 19th century, talked about, the alienation that we experience so much, the loneliness, the separateness of our society, stands in stark contrast to the kind of conviviality, use that term, of the commons?
Well, the free markets are all about impersonal transactions, and it's one-off. There's no lasting relationship. It's mediated by cash. And that causes a lot of alienation when the entire society is organized around the principles of markets. The purpose of commons, however, is to build enduring relationships that in which your labor is not something that's necessarily paid, but something you do because you have affection for each other, other people, and for the resources you're acting as a steward for. And so it's a whole different social paradigm that gets enormous amounts of work done, think of open source software or Linux, in which nobody is necessarily paid, and it's creating this massive resource of code that no corporation could possibly pay for. It's been estimated that it's worth more than $5 billion if you were to pay for all that work. The point is, the commons do all sorts of wonderful work while being socially satisfying and, as you say, convivial. And that's really what our society needs.
Why do people spend so much time doing things like creating open source software?
Well, there's a whole sociology that studies that, but it comes down to the kind of, you don't have to have a business model or a business in order to do something great. You can do it because you're talented, you have a idiosyncratic passion, and you can do it in a group context and get affirmation from your peers. All of that's really satisfying. In fact, I think even in a market context, a lot of us work that way. without the money being the chief motivator. The point of the commons is to sort of harness that power, to give it a focus and durability in something that lasts through certain systems for how you govern the shared resource, be it code or water or public spaces. And really, that's the real challenge of the commons, is devising these governance structures so that they can persist over time and so other people can join them. It's not like you have to reinvent it each time, but there's a standing cooperative, or there's a Friends of the Park, or there's this coder group, or, you know, any number of different types of commons.
And your book is called Patterns of Commoning. David Bollier, you co-wrote it with Silke Helfrich. Well, co-edited it, really, because it's a collection of essays from many people all over the world working on the commons. Helfrich's own essay is called Patterns of Commoning. What are the patterns of commoning?
Well, the pattern, there was an architect in the 1970s, Christopher Alexander, who was curious about why certain design patterns in architecture and urban spaces seemed to recur again and again over the centuries. And he developed a methodology called pattern languages, in which he helped, instead of saying there's some sort of intellectual theoretical basis for things, he saw that certain patterns persisted because they served elemental human needs and satisfactions. And they were not all identical in some uniform way, but they were patterns that sort of clustered together in certain ways. And we find this a useful way of looking at commons, because every commons is distinctive and arguably unique because of the history or the geography or the people involved in that commons. At the same time, there are certain similarities. And so it's kind of like if you know anything about fractals, where there's a similarity and difference bound up together. Well, that's the motif that we see in all sorts of commons, where certain commons will have the same ways of protecting themselves against market appropriation, people, you know, trying to steal what they're creating for market purposes. Or they'll have certain recurrent patterns of how they govern themselves through consensus and negotiation. So we wanted to sort of bring out these different patterns of commoning to show that there really is a new way of understanding how commons work.
So give us an example.
Well, in free and open source software, they've devised something called licenses. The general public license is one popular one, which is based on copyright ownership. And this license says you can use this code for whatever you want, share it, modify it, do whatever, but whatever you create cannot go private. It has to be shareable as well. Well, that is one pattern that the people who create traditional seed or raise traditional seeds find important themselves, because as more agricultural biotech companies try to patent seeds that people have passed down from generation to generation, these people are saying, well, we need a kind of license to protect heritage seeds or certain crops or things that we've shared for centuries. We shouldn't be allowed Monsanto or other companies to take those private. So they're looking at licenses for seeds. Well, there's a pattern across two different types of resources, but both aimed at protecting shared value over generations. And that's the kind of building block we use for starting to understand how commons can work.
And you mentioned seeds. Agriculture is the iconic locus of the commons. You know, most people think of the commons in the center of New England villages where people graze their sheep. One of the commons you talk about is a woman's forest commons in Rajasthan. Tell us about that commons.
Well, traditionally, women in Rajasthan have managed their forests, gathering all sorts of nuts and wood and other resources for their villages. And the state has tried to take it over through their bureaucracies and manage it scientifically and arguably in a more rigorous way. But what these women have found is that it simply dispossesses them and opens the door for all sorts of cronyism and corruption for using the forest instead. But the women have asserted themselves and overcome some of the patriarchy of the village by showing that their stewardship of the forest is extremely important for their household's livelihood and for the ecological protection of the forest itself. So it's an interesting little case study on how seemingly small-scale, informal means of managing a resource is often far more knowledgeable and sensitive about the ecosystem than somebody at a distant bureaucratic office who may know science but may not care personally about the resource. And so, you know, that's a wonderful story about on so many levels, because it shows how the importance of local self-determination, it shows the importance of women in the commons, because women have been disproportionately dependent upon commons through the ages because they have lived in a non-market world and have depended upon these shared forests or fisheries or water or farmlands. So that's a wonderful story that illustrates a lot of important lessons.
And another commons now in the developed world that is related to food is the Fresno Commons. Talk about that, a kind of integrate a commons that seeks to integrate different aspects of the food system.
Well, one of the former agriculture officials in California decided that really what needed to be done was to reinvent the supply chain for agriculture from farm to table, so that instead of investors siphoning away the surplus value created at each stage from growing to distribution to retail and restaurants, that could be mutualized for the benefit of the entire community or region. And instead of having to use pesticides and not go organic, instead of having to exploit workers and pay them a very low wage, you could start to change the whole supply chain for food in a more positive way if you managed it as a commons. From what I understand, Fresno Commons is still developing itself, but they have a very serious business plan for trying to reinvent a region's food system. And I think it's a very inspiring example what that is going to have to be emulated in other areas to, if we're going to wean ourselves from dependence upon very expensive transport and carbon heavy transport of food. So these are the kinds of innovations that are going on around the world.
So how does that work? I mean, is it like everyone from worker to consumer are part of this commons?
Well, they have essentially, for lack of a better term, a trust that manages different aspects, or that leases out different aspects of the supply chain. And so if you're a member of this, you can get certain advantages because you don't have the fierce investor-driven competition to deal with. You're dealing with the larger trust where the integrity of the whole system is the first priority rather than your own individual competitive profit. So this is, as I say, a very early stage model, but it's something I think a lot of other regions may want to think about as we try to, you know, deal with our very top-heavy, energy-intensive agriculture system.
And now, David Bollier, in this book, Patterns of Commoning, that you co-edited with Silke Helfrich, you also talk about open value networks. You mentioned two of them, Sensorica and Enspiral. I looked around on their website a bit and was trying to kind of understand how they function, how they work.
Well, these are two fledgling experiments in which people come together as, I suppose the best analogy is as a guild, meaning you have small entrepreneurs and artisans, small business people, as well as people who are involved in social advocacy and social change. And it's a network that essentially tries to create a different business model and lifestyle model in which everybody shares certain values and cultural goals, but you also share certain financial benefits. So, for example, in Enspiral, they have not only this very popular decision-making tool called Lumio, which allows people not just to vote, but to deliberate and entertain other options before coming to a decision. But they have something called co-budget, where a program that allows people to allocate parts of their bank account to certain other projects that the group is hosting. So, for example, if somebody wants to bring an important speaker to come to the community, people can say, "Hey, could you chip in some money for this person to come and put it in my bucket?" It's called. And then if enough money is raised through the group, you can do that. So it's kind of a flexible way for a network of people with mutual commitments to work together in different ways. They may work individually on their various businesses, but they also share a lot of mutual support, emotional support, and financial collaboration to make the system go. So it's really kind of a new organizational form that combines commenting and community-responsive markets.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Bollier about his new book about the burgeoning worldwide movement to create an alternative to predatory capitalism. It's called The Commons. The book is Patterns of Commoning, co-edited with Silke Helfrich. I almost wonder if you could think of a Bernie Sanders campaign as a kind of political commons. As you're talking, I mean, it puts me in mind of the fact that so much software was developed by volunteers and was open source or was shared with, free. The volunteers in the campaign were probably the largest group of campaigners as opposed to paid staff. He's talked about a political revolution from the ground up, and all you had to do was go to a Bernie Sanders rally and kind of feel the conviviality.
Well, I think that's a really fair analogy. In most campaigns, at least if they're bottom up, as Bernie's was, do have strong elements of a commons. I suppose one distinction I would make is, can it persist? Does it have the systems to persist? And in this case, obviously, the goal was to win the Democratic nomination. And once that did not succeed, or apparently has not succeeded, the question is, can it continue? I'll be really curious to see what Bernie does to try to continue his millions of active and paying supporters into a movement that persists. And I think that he has a lot of the elements, both in terms of his message, but also in terms of the infrastructure and the practices of collaborating together in the way that they did. So, you know, another commons in the making.
Yeah, exactly. Now, going from the political to the material, you talk about technology commons like Fab Lab, which I've known about for a while, just a fascinating effort there, and one that was new to me, FarmHack. Talk about technology, manufacturing communities as another part of the, another part of the landscape of the commons.
Well, the internet could be said, you could say the internet is one vast hosting infrastructure for creating commons, because there are very low barriers to entry to going on the internet and starting some collaborative project. And that's exactly what happened with FarmHack, where some people decided, you know, why should we be paying extraordinary sums of money to John Deere or other farm equipment makers when we can use open source principles to create very sophisticated equipment that is inexpensive, locally producible, modular, and shareable. It's not patented in the same way. And this would be an enormous boon to all sorts of people around the world, especially in poorer rural countries, where they could create their own farm equipment out of relatively accessible components. So FarmHack is this global design community that's created dozens of different types of agricultural machines that can be shared but can be locally built. And I find it a fascinating example of a larger phenomena of global design and local production. We have something like the WikiSpeed car, which is enormously fuel efficient, that has been created by this global community of volunteers. You have the WikiHouse, you have WikiFurniture, and many other types of models like that. And a lot of the local production aspects are dealt with through something called fab labs or makerspaces, which are essentially loose associations in a given geographic area of people who share a love of tinkering and making something their own. And you have, you know, people who are masters at it, and then you have kids or neophytes who are learning. And these fab labs and makerspaces are essentially self-organized commons that pursue their love of tinkering and building, sometimes for profit, but never at the expense of the community. It's mostly, an amateur effort to build great things. And one could say that they're incubators of cooperative innovation, which is quite distinct from the kind that, large corporations pursue.
Now, you know, there was a sharing economy that came about with Uber and Airbnb and TaskRabbit. This was supposed to empower the people, you know, be a distributed power paradigm. But it's ended up being actually exploitative in the case of Uber and TaskRabbit, and quite destructive even of affordable housing. In the case of Airbnb in large cities, like in New York, I think something like 60 to 80% of the Airbnb offerings are owned by just a few people who have bought, who have rented huge blocks of apartments and are now just putting them on Airbnb, while ordinary folks are being locked out of the market. How does this commoning movement differ from that?
Well, first of all, the whole sharing economy term is a brilliant but misleading branding device, because there's no sharing going on. It's micro rentals. It's a market. Sharing doesn't happen that way. And as the extractive, exploitative dimensions of these new business models become apparent, people are starting to mobilize and fight back, and many are starting to say, you know what, if we create this as a cooperative alternative, it's going to work much better for everyone. And that's what happened recently in the city of Austin, where Uber refused to abide by certain public regulations that the city wanted to enact. And so a nonprofit was created to create a cooperative alternative platform for ride-hailing services. And I think it's part of a larger movement that is called platform cooperativism, where efforts are being made to create essentially the co-op form for all sorts of digital open spaces, from housing to rides to tool sharing and many other types of things. It's still early in that movement's development. There was a major conference last November at the New School that explored it. But there's been an enormous response internationally to the idea of platform cooperativism as a way of combating the socially disruptive and predatory business models coming out of Silicon Valley.
And so now, from the individual example to the larger picture, the largest picture, you talk at the, you know, some of the essays in the last part of the book are about how basically to change from our culture of competition and the so-called free market to a culture of commoning. And you use this term, the pluriverse. Tell us, how can we make this transition? What is involved in changing, you know, the basic attitudes that we have? I mean, I guess we're starting... We're coming back to where we started, the basic attitudes we have toward how we interact with others of our species and the other species on this planet.
Well, I think we're caught in a terrible lock-in of culture, where our imagination is so limited or deliberately restricted that many people cannot entertain the idea of something beyond consumer-seller or a market-driven society. Yet, to look in history, or even to look cross-culturally today, is to see this fantastic diversity of human cultures, many of which, one might even say most of which, do not regard markets, or at least let's call them capital-driven markets, because certain markets are quite benign. Capital-driven markets have colonized the world. It's the essence of the neoliberal trade regime that tries to create everything as a fungible commodity to be sold, bought and sold. But the pluriverse, which is an idea presented by Arturo Escobar, who's an anthropologist and commoner, is a way to understand how human beings create all sorts of different cultures. And you could say that almost any commons is its own subjective universe of different values. But it's especially pronounced among indigenous peoples who are really integrated with their ecological environment, and their culture is there. It's kind of a mutually supportive, symbiotic relationship with the landscape. Well, I think there's some lessons for alienated modern man facing climate change from those kinds of lessons. So I think we need to open ourselves up to this cultural diversity and learn from it, especially from what indigenous peoples can teach us, not in some romanticized way, but in a way that reconnects us to each other and to the cosmos in ways they've lived for millennia.
And this actually puts me back to this current political campaign. You know, I began to see this the twin poles of the Sanders campaign and the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign based on exclusion and hatred and fear. The Bernie Sanders campaign talked about a moral economy like the Pope does. You know, talked about not me, us. Almost as if these are the two possible reactions to the terrible crises that we face.
And I think we also saw the limits of pursuing that in an electoral, indeed a presidential arena. And I think we have some cultural work to do before we can prevail at those levels. At the same time, what a surprise to everyone that Bernie Sanders was able to mobilize such a vast constituency who believed with that general perspective. And I mean, and that is really a very hopeful sign that people are willing to entertain system change at a very personal and social level. And that an election is not simply about policy or those people in Washington. It comes down to how we want to live our lives and how we want to contribute to improve things. And so I would like to see that cultural energy channeled into building new types of commons at our local and regional and internet levels, so that this sensibility, this belief in the feasibility of sharing and collaboration and reciprocity can grow and eventually build a different type of economy.
Well, and your books, the latest of which is Patterns of Commoning, are a very important part of that. David Bollier, it has always been a pleasure to talk with you about this really transformative and so necessary new worldview, the commoning worldview. And your book is Patterns of Commoning.
Thank you again. It was a joy to talk with you again.
David Bollier is an author, activist, blogger, and consultant who explores the commons as a new paradigm of economics, politics, and culture. He's been on the trail for about 15 years, working with a variety of international and domestic partners. In 2010, he co-founded the Commons Strategy Group, a consulting project that works to promote the commons internationally. You can read excerpts from Patterns of Commoning by going to writersvoice.net. And in fact, in the spirit of the commons, you can read much more by going to the book's website. Find the link at writersvoice.net. Next up, we revisit our October 2015 interview with Juliana Barbosa about Rio de Janeiro and the preparations for the Olympic Games. Stay tuned after the break.
A dog. It's been a hard day's night. I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get into you, I find the things that I do. You make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy your things. And it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why I love to come home, 'cause when I get you alone,
back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Olympic Games in Rio are happening against the backdrop of a Brazil embroiled in economic and political crisis. That crisis had already started to boil when we first aired our interview with Juliana Barbosa about her book, Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink. It's about how the preparations for the Olympic Games revealed the cracks in the Brazilian miracle. Let's hear an edited version of that interview now that the games are happening. As we're putting together this week's show, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff faces impeachment as her government is rocked by scandal and her country's economy struggles in recession. It wasn't supposed to be like that. In 2009, Brazil was the first Latin American country to be chosen to host the Olympic Games, slated for Rio in 2016. It was an indication that the country had arrived as a major player on the world stage. But even back then, serious questions were raised about Rio's readiness to host the Games. Questions about violence from criminal gangs, rampant corruption, and pollution from uncontrolled development. In her beautifully reported book, Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, my guest, Juliana Barbosa, reveals the cracks in the Brazilian miracle, taking her native city, Rio, as the example. She writes about epic battles between police and gangs, the resistance put up by poor communities to being swept away by development, and the ecological disaster that threatens Rio's fabled beaches. Juliana Barbosa went to Rio in 2010 as AP's Rio correspondent. You went there just after the announcement that Brazil had been awarded the 2016 Olympics. One of the things that Lula, who was the president at the time, promised the Olympic Committee was that Rio would be safe for the Olympic Games. Why was that an issue?
Well, Rio de Janeiro's reputation has been for a very long time that of a dangerous city. And I have to say, as somebody who was there, you know, visited, and I lived there for a brief period in the 80s, that reputation was well-deserved during the 1980s and the 1990s in particular. There was a lot of pickpocketing, petty crime in the streets. Brazilians driving wouldn't stop at a red light after 10 p.m., for example, out of fear of being carjacked. And so this was a very real, very concrete concern if you're talking about hosting a major international event. And Brazil and Rio had to show that they were already doing something to deal with this, not just the reputation, but the fact of criminality in Rio. And they were. Rio had this innovative, never attempted before in the city program that had as one of its goals bringing down the levels of crime in the city. This program was putting police officers into very specific favelas, which are low-income communities, many of them which had been taken over by drug dealers, by drug-dealing gangs, and essentially abandoned by the state for a very long time. So now police was going into these areas, occupying them, establishing round-the-clock presence, and in doing so, basically eliminating these safe zones for people who could go commit crimes in the city at large and then, you know, hide back in these areas. So they didn't just promise that they would deal with it. They were actually implementing a program that was, for the first time in over 20 years, trying to tackle this very serious issue. And that was one of the questions that I had when I came back is, will this work? What are the costs of this program? Not even financially, but speaking in terms of the life of the people who live in these communities, who I figured would be affected pretty intensely by this round-the-clock, you know, policing effort. What would it mean for the city at large? Would Rio be able to pull this off in a satisfactory way? And it's one of the things that I deal with in the book. I feel like it's an unfolding issue, but I could see, even in 2014, which is when the book ends, that a lot of this was already starting to come unraveled, unfortunately. A lot of these expectations were failing to produce the anticipated, the much hoped for results.
One of the most interesting aspects of this book is how it looks at how difficult it is, really, for a society to change. We think of Brazil now as a place of tremendous development, and yet institutional structures also hold it back. Give us the overview of where Brazil has come from in the 21 years you were away, and what's changed and what's remained the same.
Well, it's very interesting because Brazil has changed a lot or not at all, depending on who you are and where you're standing. It has changed a lot. As somebody who, again, the last time that I lived in Brazil was in the mid-80s. So Brazil was transitioning from a military regime to a democracy. The economy was roller coastering all over the place during this period of tremendous flux. There was hyperinflation. People couldn't plan their lives. People couldn't make it. The majority of Brazilians could not make ends meet and had doubts about how they were going to feed themselves at the end of the month. Very, very difficult circumstances. And so if you look at that Brazil, if you lived that Brazil, and you see Brazil now with a substantial middle class, yes, a middle class that's being increasingly squeezed by, you know, hiking interest rates, by increasing inflation again, but it's a middle class that's there, a middle class that's often out in the streets, has been, you know, for various reasons over the past couple of years, making demands of its government. The quality of life for most Brazilians has improved very much in this last 20 years or so, 20, 25 years or so. So if you look at it that way, it's a tremendous change. What has not changed, and what I think is equally important, is, as you said, the underpinning structures. While it's true that for a lot of people can afford things that they could not afford before, you see people with smartphones all over the place, a lot more Brazilians have cars now, things like that, material things. What has not changed is who really holds power, who actually is tapping onto the big sources of money in the country. That has not changed. There's a lot of hope that that would change when the Workers' Party came into power, which happened in the early 2000s. And that party did bring a lot of policies that benefited Brazilians who had never seen the government do anything for them, i.e. the poorest classes. But unfortunately, the biggest structures of power were not shaken, and that's the part that's most disappointing in this big transformation. I had hoped for a deeper shift that would really realign the power structures. That is a lot to hope for, as you said. These are big questions. How does a society change? And one of the answers that we got out of Brazil is, even a big political change, even putting the representative of the working class in power for the first time in Brazil's history, did not make the change go deep enough. There's a lot there. So,
you say, Juliana Barbosa, you say in Dancing with the Devil in the City of God that Brazil is being judged not only by its GDP, but also by its record on human rights, equality, justice, environmental sustainability, and quality of life. Let's start with human rights. You mentioned the military regime. That was a dictatorship. It was overthrown. Democracy came in. What's the status of human rights now?
Well, this is one of the big disappointments, as I mentioned. One would hope that, 20 years into, over 20 years now, gosh, but, several decades into a democracy, and with, as I mentioned, this more substantial middle class, we would see things like better human rights conditions, people who are the most vulnerable and most disenfranchised being treated a little bit better. And we're not seeing that. The police is still very lethal. The police in Brazil in general and in Rio de Janeiro it's hard to explain this to Americans, but a lot of Brazilians are afraid of the police. I saw a survey that 60% of Brazilians are afraid, actually, of the police force in their town. In 2007, which was the most lethal year for the police in Rio, the state police of Rio de Janeiro killed about 1,330 people. The police themselves did. And so when you talk about human rights, you're talking about things like this as well. The way the state treats its own most vulnerable population. And unfortunately, we have not seen a change that's deep enough. Just to give one more example, once Rio was awarded the right to host the Olympics, less than 2 months after that announcement came out, Rio's mayor published a list of 119 favelas that would be razed before the Olympics came to Rio. And so 119 communities, if you think about how many families are involved in that. And this was just published in the newspaper. He gave an interview about this. These people were not told. There were no city agents to go there to talk to them, to explain to them personally what this is going to mean for them. Just, they just learned from the news that from one day to the next, their houses are going to be destroyed, their community is going to be razed, and they don't know what's coming next. You know, when I talk about human rights, I mean things like that as well. The way that the poorest are treated by their own government, we have not seen a real change in that in Brazil, and that's most unfortunate.
You went to talk with some of the residents. Well, you spent a fair amount of time in some of the favelas, the poor communities of Rio. But one of them was Metro. They organized to prevent this displacement. What was your experience of the residents and their fight, and what happened?
I spent a lot of time in these favelas because I felt like they are one of the places where you can really judge whether this transformation that Brazil was going through, there's a lot of talk about this transformation that Brazil was going through. The favelas were one of the places where you could really see if this was really happening or not, and or how deep it really was going. And, as I mentioned, the way that these announcements were made, the way that the residents were treated as officials came in to say they have to leave, the options that they were given. I mean, many laws were violated. There were a lot of legal issues involved in that. But to me, at the core of it is this continuing disrespect, not just for the legal rights, but the civil rights, the human rights of the poorest. And that's very revealing of where the country is. But also equally revealing, I felt, is the fact that many of these communities are organizing in a way that they haven't before. Removals happened in Brazil, removals of favelas happened in Brazil and in Rio de Janeiro in particular, also in the 60s and 70s. And there was very little that communities could do back then to push back. And now you see communities like Metro, like Vila Autódromo, another one that I talk about, and several others that did a wonderful job of coming together, of organizing, of tapping the media, of getting out there on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, and telling their story, working also with nonprofits in Rio that are now very well entrenched and very much in connection with these communities. So the atmosphere, the environment in which these violations happen is different. And there's more, to use a very often used word in these contexts, but they are more empowered. And that was one of the most interesting things that I saw in Brazil. That was one of the instances of real change that, made me feel like, okay, I didn't come back for nothing. This something interesting is really going on.
So the revolution of rising expectations.
Indeed, exactly.
The book centers not just around the upcoming Olympics, but also around a number of other sporting events. You mentioned 2007, the Pan American Games. Later, there was the 2014 World Cup. Why are sports events such a good lens for looking at what's going on in Brazil?
Because you can trace, especially because we had three in Rio, right? The Pan American Games, the World Cup, and the Olympics. You can trace the way that this has worked to develop a certain part of town. For example, there was this conscious choice to put most of the Pan American Games infrastructure and the vast majority of the Olympic Games' infrastructure in the western part of Rio, which is also the wealthiest part of Rio. It's the real estate frontier where building, it's a construction zone now. There's so much happening there. And where really one would argue you don't need more public investment, right? You don't need more public money going there. But when you have these events and you sell them to the population as, you know, very positive for the city, we're going to have visitors, we're going to have tourism dollars, we're going to have the world looking at us, it's going to be good for all of us. And in the meantime, you're funneling a lot of money to these parts of town that are already wealthy and getting even more infrastructure like transit routes, the metro line, when there are other parts of town that really, really need that kind of attention and are not getting it. And, you know, to make things worse in Rio, this part of town that's getting the majority of the infrastructure, the Olympic infrastructure, and also got, you know, the majority of the Pan American Games infrastructure, is a landscape that's also very different from the rest of the city in the sense that it's a very unequal landscape. It's an area that's built very differently from everything else. You've got gated communities and highways, essentially. It's not a pedestrian-friendly area. It's concentrated around areas of exclusivity. And, you know, Rio is already an unequal city. It has that reputation, and it is very much so, in fact. So you're only fostering more development, a very unequal model of a very unequal lifestyle and urban development model. So it's very negative for the city. And looking at the sports events and the planning around them and the funneling of money that happens around them allows you to see that this is not a coincidence. The same people, the same politicians have been behind bringing these games to Rio de Janeiro. And they are also in close collaboration with these major developers who are building all that infrastructure. So it's a good lens for that reason. It lets you cut through straight to where's the money going, how's it being used, who's benefiting.
Another thing you talk about in this book, Juliana Barbosa, in Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, is the environmental toll that all this development, and specifically the development around all these sports events, is taking. For example, you visit the area of development for the Olympic Games with an ecologist because it's right in the middle of caiman habitat. You went right into the muck there. What's happening to these alligators, these caimans?
Yeah, I loved being able to get in there in the muck with that biologist and go essentially hunting for alligators with him as a way of talking about how all this development is impacting the environment because it's so concrete, right? I mean, you see the animals, you see their habitat, and you see the cement encroaching. Again, this very wealthy part of Rio, the west side of Rio, is also caiman or, you know, a cousin of the alligator habitat. And as it grows very, very fast, often with very little concern for the environment, very little, few impact studies that really count, there's a tremendous clash of this natural environment with this, you know, man-made environment. And you literally have these crocodilians right next to high-end million-dollar penthouses. And, you know, the residents coming down in their fancy workout gear and, you know, heading out to the beach and, you know, checking out the biologists and they're working with the alligators. You can see how these things are pushing against each other in a very concrete, understandable way. And you can also see one of my pet peeves, one of the things I really try to focus on too, is how poor the sewerage situation is in Rio. And when you have such fast development in an area with such poor existing infrastructure, and this is expensive infrastructure to put into place, you have essentially sewage that ends up in rivers and lakes and in the ocean. And the looking at the crocodilians, at these caimans, lets you talk about, the very concrete impact that this has. And plus, it's really fun. You know, you get to be in there with the alligators.
You followed this river all the way to the source as a way of talking about clean water. And I think this also points out that when habitat is being destroyed for caimans, it's also being destroyed for humans.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to... part of what I really hoped to do with the book is stay away from vague concepts of, it's important to preserve the environment because the future and all of these things, and really get down to just keep your feet on the ground and show the reader specifically what's happening and why it matters, what it looks like, what it smells like. And so, you know, I got in there with the alligators and I followed this river from the feet of the Christ, you know, the iconic Christ statue at the top of this beautifully forested hill in the middle of a national park in Rio, just a couple of miles in down to where it empties into the bay, and how it becomes essentially a sewage canal along the way. So, you know, when you hear these stories about, oh, you know, the water in Rio is polluted, and are the Olympic Games going to be able to be pulled off when, you know, you're going to have sailing in a dirty bay, I wanted to get in there and show people how this happens, you know, and why it becomes this way. And again, I wanted to understand, you know, as a Brazilian, as a person living in Rio and smelling that sewage, I wanted to know how it becomes this way.
Another environmental issue with tragic implications was the clear cutting of forests, which led to devastating mudslides and floods. And again, you went to interview the families. What did you find?
Well, this happened soon after I moved to Rio de Janeiro, and it was one of the most devastating, from a personal perspective, experiences I've ever had, both as a journalist and as an individual. Because, you know, I came back to Rio, and it's a place I care very much about. It's a city where my family lives that I've longed to come back to for a long time. I'm finally reporting in my home language, you know, the language of my childhood and of my family. And one of the very first things that happens after I arrive is this massive disaster where over 1,000 people died. And over a series of days when the rains just wouldn't stop, and they essentially melted these mountains, especially in the areas that had been clear cut and where people had built houses, you know, without with little planning, with no authorization and no foundations, etc. And so it was a disaster in the making. Anyone who looks at this area can see that. And the thing is, there are many areas like this in Rio, basically waiting for another major storm to liquefy the mountains and bring them crashing down. It talks about the way that, again, it's environmental concerns are they're not just there for sort of these vague feel-good reasons. They have very concrete consequences, not just for trees and animals, but for people. We are part of this habitat, and we can be killed as a result of our neglect. It came home to me in a like a punch, essentially, when I was there for that week.
Juliana Barbosa. You can hear the rest of our 2015 interview with her by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.